Welcome back to Happy Porch Radio, the podcast for progressive agency owners and web professionals. Season 3 is focused on the growing number of agencies who are making the world a better place. We explore what this even means. Why is it different from any other agency? And how can it be reconciled with the real-world challenges of running a profitable agency? Join your host, Barry O'Kane, as he speaks to leaders of agencies who are driven by their values to positively impact the world around them.
A leading cause of death amongst males aged 18 to 44 in Australia is suicide, a topic that can be tough to raise with your typical tough Aussie bloke. My guest in this episode founded a non-profit organisation to tackle this issue head-on, and 7 years later, this also sprouted an agency. William Stubbs and his co-founder have launched the business with a very clearly defined set of values and a mission to not only continue to build on the success of their own foundation, but also to use their experiences and skills to help others plan, design, implement, and measure campaigns to, in his words, make the world better, better in a real way. The genesis of Spur Labs, which is William's agency, is a fascinating story, and one that seems so different to the founding of the other values-driven agencies I have spoken to so far in this season. And there is so much in his words that will inspire and encourage all of us, no matter where we are on this journey with our own agencies. So let's meet William.
So my name is William Stubbs. I'm from Brisbane, Australia, and the closest approximation for what I do seems to be a social entrepreneur, which I have many thoughts about and not all of them good. But in short, I have a nonprofit that I've been running with a really, really talented fellow named Lee Crockford for about 7 years now. We've been working together, which we started in a warehouse here in Brisbane, just as a couple of young guys with a few other founders, and started working on mental health campaigns to combat suicide in Australia. And really the issue that we were tackling is that if you're an Australian man aged 14 to 44, the number one way that you will die is suicide. So more than skin cancer, drugs and alcohol, heart disease, road accidents, suicide will kill you more than anything else. And for a country that does have, you know, ridiculous UV rays and a very strong drinking culture, that to us seemed crazy. That, you know, we are a very lucky country, but with this huge unspoken problem. And a lot of the rhetoric for many, many years was that you know, it's best not to talk about it. And it was a very clinical approach. And so we thought at the time, well, you know what, we should try doing something different. And there were some reports that came out with new advice about how, if you were to start talking about this, that this is the way that you should do it. In fact, a lot of the advice that had been there about suicide is something that if you talk about it, it creates more suicides. A lot of that was redacted. And actually the new rationale was that the more that we don't address this problem, the bigger it's going to get. So we started with this premise, I think, really, and particularly for your demographic for this podcast. And I think interesting that we applied marketing techniques to our campaigns in a very strong sense, and particularly around the concept of social marketing. And I want to distinguish that very carefully from social media marketing, but rather social marketing. So marketing in terms of behavioral change for social good and social impact. So for instance, our very first campaign, and I'm not sure how you feel about strong language of the podcast.
It's fine, crack on.
Barry, but crack on. I'm talking an Irishman after all, so it should be fine. In Australia, though, there's this very common phrase that as a boy growing up, you'll hear ad infinitum. Like it's something that just gets pummeled into your brain, which is toughen the fuck up or harden the fuck up. And it starts as you kind of hit that teenage years, about 13, you start hearing this thing a lot from schoolmates and even parents and older role models. What that creates is this culture where as an Aussie bloke, you're taught to be stoic and strong and invincible. And that means that if you at any point need help, or you're imperfect, or you are wounded in some way, particularly in some way that is emotional, it's completely against the programming for you to say, you know what, I need help and I have a problem. So looking at that, and that was a main driver for why men suicide at a much higher rate than women, we came up with the concept of a campaign called Soften the Fuck Up. And it was a remarkably powerful message that whenever I mention it, the campaign name to an Australian or a New Zealander, they kind of have this brief moment of confusion and then a smile goes across their face and they start laughing. Because what I love about the campaign is that it incorporates everything you need to know about what we are tackling, what we want you to do, and what the end result is in that one line. And that campaign, we designed it to be much the antithesis of what had existed up until that point. If you looked at a lot of the promotional material or the collateral for depression and anxiety, it was black and white pamphlets with, you know, a guy on the edge of his bed with his head in his hands, and it said depression across the top. And yeah, not really kind of the sort of thing you want to look at when you're depressed, actually, funnily enough. And for myself, when I was 12, I had a really tough upbringing, a lot of illness in the family and a lot of dysfunction, a lot of turmoil. And I started getting sick as well when I was about 12, and I missed out on a lot of school. And it got to the point where I was quite heavily depressed. And I don't actually think, I know that none of my family were actually aware of how bad my emotions were or my mental state. And around 12, I became suicidal, and I became very, very close to taking my own life. And so it was when I was, geez, how old am I now? So I'm 30 now. So it would have been when I was 20, about 23, 24, that we started this campaign. So it had a long time between when I was depressed in my teenage years to starting this campaign. And I was able to look back and think about how I felt and what did I actually really want to look at. And yeah, it was going to be something that was very approachable, that was engaging and spoke to me like just a guy rather than a patient. And so that became the crux of what we did as the very first campaign for Spur Projects, which became our full registered nonprofit organization here in Australia. Since then, we developed an approach to combating suicide and alleviating mental illness that is very much about dissected approaches. So over the years, we didn't just go with that one campaign. While that has won awards and it's been studied by a number of universities, which to me is terribly ironic because we were just a couple of guys that wanted to have a crack at something. The campaign, you know, was great, but we realized that it wasn't for everybody. So we launched a few more campaigns over the years for different demographics, still focusing on men. And then a few experimental things, like we've launched two large big data gathering projects, including one last year that used a smartphone app to gather real-time mental health data around the world. It was an app that we designed ourselves. All the UX, the methodology behind it was something that we created in conjunction with ANU University. And as a result, I think we broke a world record, actually, in terms of the largest real-time mental health survey ever, with about 11,000 people partaking for a week in 105 countries, 9 different languages, and around 60,000 data submissions that came out of that. So that became a free open source repository of mental health data. So you could look at based on profession, age, gender identity, sexual identity, location, activity, whatever you want to know, how does that affect your mental health? And over time. So really, really cool stuff. The challenge for us became that at the time, Lee and I were really running the organization at this point. Our original co-founders had gone on to some pretty amazing things. We had a volunteer team that have a range of incredible skills that we're able to kind of beg, borrow, and steal for different projects and purely based on passion and occasionally buy them some burgers. But we never succeeded with grant funding or corporate sponsorship or anything.
So you were doing all of this while also working in another, your own income? It wasn't coming from this? You were doing this sort of on the side?
No. So we've never been paid a salary by the nonprofit. We have I think in about the 6 or 7 years we've been running, we've probably had less than 50 grand come through the account. And that's mostly from a couple of fundraising campaigns that we launched called Get Silent, Get Heard, where we modeled it, I would say, on 48-hour famine, if you're familiar with that campaign. So we said, well, what's the analogy for depression, anxiety then? Well, it's silence and not talking about it. So we challenged our followers to not talk for 48 hours and have their friends and family sponsor them to do that, with donations going to us to continue to run our campaigns. And if you're somebody like me, you have people lining up to want to pay you to shut up. So it was pretty successful. We had, I think in the first year that we ran it, we raised $20,000 just from our followers wanting to help out. But yeah, we'd never, and continue to actually, even this week, there was a couple of grant applications that came back with a negative. And we've just never been successful with that. And I think my suspicion is that we are kind of in a classroom. I'm not sure if you had this growing up, but you know, it was always that kid in the corner who was off doing their own thing, not really following what the teacher was telling them to do. And you know, there was probably like some sharp implement they were using to craft some really weird gadget they were working on or something. And that's kind of us as an organization. And so, you know, we use strong language deliberately. We use that as a tool to engage people in a particular way. We do experiments that haven't been done before that people don't want to help pay for, but they're happy to take the results of. Interestingly, last year in a federal election for Australian government, one of the senators actually endorsed us officially. And she came out as saying that we've done amazing work, and that if they won the election, they were going to give us $500,000 election promise grant to do with as we wish and help us kind of really get established properly. They didn't win, fortunately. So we were back to kind of running it, yeah, alongside our day jobs. The twist that happened here is that Lee and I had been picked up by a consulting firm, a management consulting firm here in our city, Brisbane, who had lost a consultant to suicide. And they wanted to, I think, do something about it and feel like they, almost like a catharsis, I suppose, of get involved in it somehow. So they worked with us for, I think, six months maybe. And in that time, helped us structure some things a bit better, really progress towards being a better organized organization. And in that time, they actually said to us, well, come work for us. Come be consultants. Don't ask questions about what that is. Just come and do it. And you'll figure it out. And we did. And it was a great organization in the sense that they gave us the freedom and understanding to know that it wasn't our life working for them. We had this other passion project we were working on. What happened as a result of working there for 3 years is that Lee and I found a couple of things. One, in order to really take this, what is essentially an altruistic marketing and design organization to the next level, we needed to really talk about funds seriously. We needed to not be able to have to use annual leave time to go and be at conferences and present our work, but actually be able to do this as a full-time job. The second thing is we've kind of looked at how the firm we were working for was running and go, well, you know, we wouldn't do it that way. We have some ideas of how we would do this. And we've always, I think, been that way. And the third thing was we started getting approached by some large organizations. So the largest telco in Asia Pacific, for instance, made us their foundation ambassadors and invited us to mentor their nonprofits in a program where they took in nonprofits and helped them to figure out how to be more design thinking oriented or more innovative. There was also a large advertising firm that I probably shouldn't name, but they took us out for lunch and picked our brain on a campaign, which they later won as a result. And we went, oh, shit, we actually know what we're doing. we're pretty good at this. So maybe we should be doing this. And I remember talking to Lee and I kind of pitched in this idea of, well, we have Spur Projects, which is our non-for-profit. And what if we created Spur Labs, which would be a sister company that would take everything we'd learned about how to create really compelling and impactful social marketing projects, take everything we'd learned about how to measure the impact of those projects, and everything we'd learned about how to utilize experimental technology projects to create impact, and do it for other people and charge them for it. And if we were doing that, it's kind of a win-win-win, because we would be doing the work that we're really passionate about anyway, which is creating a positive social impact in the world through clever design, thinking, technology, and creativity. We would also be able to use some of those funds to fund the work that we are really particularly close to, which is our Spur Projects mental health work. And it would actually benefit people anyway. And I'm a really big believer in that concept of find a way for your business to do good in the way that it does business, not as an accessory to doing business. So that idea kind of brewed for about a year. We kind of got really, really busy with launching the app project last year, a bunch of other things and other projects we were working on. And then this year, it just kind of came together as, you know what, we really need to do this. So we launched, well, actually, I went to Germany in June for the G20 as a young entrepreneur delegate and a representative of my city to Berlin. Came back, we launched Spur Labs officially and hired an ex-Ogilvy managing director who wanted a chance to work for us as an advisor and, as he put it, feed his soul, which I thought was a lovely way to look at it. And then I went back on a plane to Denmark to partake in a United Nations innovation lab for 2 weeks. So I kind of left Lee with, you know, running the company. But I wasn't complaining. And since then, we have built a really compelling, I think, model of how it works. Essentially, is that Spur Labs is owned by Lee, myself, and a third share by Spur Projects. So it is owned by the nonprofit itself, which we thought was really important to imbue the company with that sense of altruism. And it is designed to fund our work, our positive impact work. Secondly, in the charter for the company, a minimum of 5% of revenue, not profit, but revenue, is put directly into Spur Projects. So before we pay anybody in the company, 5% is taken and put into the nonprofit. And then 20% at least of employee time in Spur Labs is given to Spur Projects to continue those campaigns.
That's really interesting. So you've sort of not, rather than just saying that that's going to happen, you've built that into the frame, like legally, I guess. I'm trying to find the right frame word to describe that there.
I'm not sure if it's like legally in that, you know, what would happen if we didn't do it. It's more that from a constitution perspective. So we would be considered not following the constitution of our business as a director, for instance, if we weren't upholding that. And it's very core to the culture of the company. So we created a strong framework for what we do and how we do things, what we believe in. And one of those things is that very much at the heart of it, why did we start this company? We could have gone and done a bunch of different things. We chose to do this company. And the reason we chose to do this company is what includes that we're funding the nonprofit work that we do. So it was actually funny when we closed our first client, which is a hospital group, quite a large one here in Brisbane. And you know, we're very excited to get some money coming in the door, as you would be. And we had that initial kind of chat about, well, at what point does that 5% to the nonprofit kick in? And we had to kind of quickly check in. We both agreed, yes, no, it has to start from the very get-go. You know, if you set yourself that goal or that belief in what you're doing, it needs to be there from the very beginning. And there's a phrase that we have a lot of these kind of mottos, but one of them is that begin as you wish to proceed. And so we couldn't, I don't think, set this expectation that once we hit, you know, X amount of revenue, well, then we'll start that funnel. It had to be from the very get-go. So even if we had been paid, you know, $50 for a 10-minute consultation, we would still do that 5% straight away. Mm.
So that's what I think is interesting, that you're, and I guess my question about sort of building that into your constitution, building that into the core of the company that you're creating, rather than saying, oh, we're going to do this, or we want to do this, or one day we'll do this.
Yeah.
But actually, it's really built into the framework.
Yeah. And I particularly over the last couple of years, so a lot of the consulting work that I did prior to launching Spur Labs was for government and corporate. And I became increasingly disenchanted with a lot of the business world in the sense that I've done a lot of work with the startup community and consulting on, you know, how to grow a startup community and how to empower startup founders, which is, of course, very vogue right now. And combining that with the innovation lab I went to in Denmark, where I was working with 1,000 other change makers, I would say in air quotes, that have been selected for this program, as well as large, huge corporates that were looking at social impact investment. This belief has really formed in my brain quite strongly that business is broken, and it has been broken for a number of decades. And what's happened is entrepreneurs, though I do hate the term, used to start businesses to have freedom because they didn't want to work for somebody else and they wanted to create something that didn't exist. And they wanted freedom. What's happened since, or in the last couple of maybe 20 years, maybe a bit more, actually probably more, is that we've shifted from that to people will start companies purely and solely to make profit. And I know to many people that probably sounds rather obvious and well, yeah, like why else would you start a company? My argument is rather if you look at Henry Ford, for instance, who started the Ford Motor Company, he's a great example of an entrepreneur that didn't really care so much about making money as success and making something worthwhile. Money is just a tool in order to get there. You know, but he was very conscious of what impact he was having. And in fact, there was time when he built an entire town for his employees to work in to make sure they had appropriate housing that was close to the factory, so their commute wasn't long, that they, you know, were looked after. And I think what I've noticed is that there's this rise of you know, large corporates where they'll start, they'll become successful, they'll have a bunch of money and a bunch of success. And then they go, well, you know what? We should create a foundation, because if we create a foundation, it looks good for us, right? And that's corporate social responsibility, and that's wonderful. And so they create a foundation with a side to it. We've gone kind of the reverse, and we've created a foundation or a nonprofit, and then created a for-profit company off the side of that, which feeds back into the foundation. That might not work. It's not been very long, and it might crash and burn. But it's another way of showing how you can do business. And it meant that core to what we do, every time that we work with a client, we're delivering value to them by doing the work that we do. So whether it's improving their market awareness for their ethically produced product, or it is helping them to measure how effective their social impact campaign is, or whatever it is, we're adding value to them, to the people that they serve, as well as we're adding value to the nonprofit work that we do and hopefully saving lives. Additionally, and not to kind of go on a rant about business and why I think it's broken, but one of the core things that we set in our charter was that Spur Labs will only ever work on projects that have some positive impact. And that means that if an oil company said to us, you know, work with us, here's $1 million, rebrand us, we would say no thanks. If they said, here's $1 million, rebrand us as an ethical oil company, we would say, sure, absolutely, that sounds great. But the only way to be that is to actually be ethical. And so we're going to help you to figure out how to do that. So it has to be an ethical or a positively social impact piece of work, otherwise we just won't do it.
And do you have a clear definition of what you mean by, you know, positive and what ethical? Or is that something that's more based on a case by case?
That's a very good question. And I always hate it when somebody asks me that because it is evolving. It's hard because somebody posed me the other day, okay, but what if that oil company had no interest in being ethical in its practices, but it donates $5 billion to women's education in the developing world? So by helping them do more business, you're helping benefit people down the line. And that's a really tricky one. And so I had to come back to this concept of direct social impact. So if an example would be Tesla Motors. On the surface, they are a wholly for-profit company, right? And they produce these luxury cars that I adore. No, I would love to have one, and hopefully one day I will. But I absolutely do not need. I don't need a car, and many of us actually do not need cars, but we're told that we do. However, by creating the company Tesla, every time they do sell a car, hopefully that means one less fossil fuel based car being on the road. That is a direct social impact. Whereas working with a company that, let's say, yeah, produces fossil fuel based vehicles, and it produces as a result 100 million tons of carbon dioxide comes out of those vehicles every year, and they donate $1 billion to women's education in the developing world. Does that seem like a fair trade-off? It's really hard, but it comes down to, for me, by working with that particular client, am I, in doing that work, moving the needle forward, or is the needle being affected by several steps that I have no direct control over? And if the answer is the latter, then I probably shouldn't be involved in that.
Mm-hmm. That's actually, this is a theme that is coming up a lot in this series, is this challenge to define what the criteria is of the type of work that we do with an agency that's, or using our professional skills to, or whatever the values driven part of that conversation is. Your answer just there tied back to something you said earlier as well about, and I can't remember the exact phrase, but about the business, like it being inherent in the business rather than an output or a side thing from the business. I thought that was an interesting way of phrasing it, or way of describing it too.
I'm increasingly of the opinion that we really need to redefine the term entrepreneur and the understanding of what business is, right? And I get, as I mentioned earlier, I get called a social entrepreneur, and I actually really struggle with that, but it's the closest thing that I can think of to describe easily and quickly what I actually do. Off the back of the lab in Denmark, there's a third company that we're setting up, which produces a scalable tool for refugee support that won an award in the lab, and seems like a really cool idea. So we're prototyping that and setting it up. And so I've inherited from my dad, who was an entrepreneur, a sense of wanting to build things, and I'm good at building things. But for me, it has to be about building something that makes the world better and legitimately better, not just easier to order a coffee kind of better, but actually better. What I've noticed though, is that when we call somebody an entrepreneur these days, particularly since the rise of technology and Silicon Valley and everything, there's a really, really great quote by one of the early Facebook engineers, Jeffrey Hammerbach, I believe, who said he quit Facebook. And when he was asked why he quit, he said, "We have," and I'm paraphrasing, "but we have the greatest minds of our generation figuring out how to get you to click ads faster." And to me, that's like a really, really good example that we have become so focused on squeezing more money out of everything we're doing rather than thinking, how does this actually affect the world? Now, the flip side to that is money is fine and money is not evil. I like things. I'm a minimalist personally, but I do like nice things. And yes, I'd love to buy a Tesla one day. But I firmly believe that as we are approaching a reality where we have increasingly hugely disastrous occurrences in nature, and if you look at Mexico having the earthquake this week and hurricanes onslaughting the United States, we have a serious problem to face in the fact that the world has consumed much more than it should have. We've created a culture on where in the Western world particularly, we want much more than we should actually have. To fix that, we need to redefine not only consumption, but business. And business needs not be about, hey, business entrepreneur guy, you figure out how to make as much profit as you possibly can and be damned how you actually do it. That's irrelevant. So if you're going to steal somebody's data, if you're going to take money to dump oil in a lake, if you're going to produce t-shirts that an average cotton t-shirt takes 3,000 liters of water to produce one t-shirt, and throw them into H&M and see how many you can sell. And if those you don't sell, slash them and dump them in a trash pile somewhere. That's not working. And it's clearly not working. So my view of what, and I'm going on a rant, I apologize. But my view of what, if we are going to be sustainable as a species and a planet moving forward, is that business is an extremely powerful tool. And so it needs to be redefined to mean that you make profit by improving the world. Legitimately improving. The trick is that's really hard to figure out.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. It's so a lot of that makes, and some of those decisions are very clear cut. Should I dump this oil in that lake or not?
Right.
But
probably not.
But in terms of the much more mundane, smaller decisions you're making, like, for example, should I work with this client or not? Or how should I promote this campaign? Or how do I make sure that I am getting paid, me and the team are getting paid, and we are earning some sort of profit while still not compromising these values? And how do you bring that rant that you just had, which is incredibly inspiring, how do you bring that down to the day-to-day?
There's a lot of questions in that statement, Barry. Where do I start? Look, and yeah, I mean the obvious thing I would attack there is that you got to live, right? And you've got to eat and you've got to pay the bills. And I'm saying this, I know, as a 30-year-old white dude who is straight, cisgender, living in one of the wealthiest countries in the world from a good education, and I have no partner or kids. And so I'm coming at from a very, very much place of privilege. And I totally appreciate that. It's not as easy to go on a rant like that to somebody who is just trying to get by. That being said, I think it's important that people like me who have that sense of privilege to say those things. You know, I went through a big transformation the last few years of letting go of things and realizing, oh, I don't need to buy that thing I wanted to buy. I got rid of like 80% of my clothes, and now I have a spreadsheet that tells me exactly every item I have, and you know, if I ever need to get something, I have a calculation as to how much I actually need it. And I think, one, we need to be more comfortable with having less. That does mean high quality things, because you want them to last long, but having less things. And so things like, we have agreed in Spare Labs that we will only probably work from co-working spaces for a very, very long time, but perhaps forever. And I do think that is the way the world is going. You don't need to have your own studio in most cases. You don't need to pay the rent for an entire building in most cases. It also means you have greater collaboration opportunities and so on. The flip side to that is, yeah, you're going to have sometimes where you're going to have that really hard question of, do you work with that client or not? I wish I had an easy answer for that. So far, So in Spurt Projects, a bigger mental health organization with very, very, very little funding, we have been approached about 3 times by alcohol companies wanting to give us just like, here's a 15K check, just, you know, put our name on something and do with it whatever you want to do with it. And every time we said no. After much consternation and beating our heads against a wall, we went back and said, no, thank you, appreciate it, but we can't really do that. And the reason being that I've nothing against having a drink, but as a mental health organization, being aligned with alcohol probably isn't on brand. And so there have been times where I wish that I could have just said yes to that. And I have no doubt that there'll be times where Spur Labs will have clients or potential clients knocking on our door asking to work with us when it doesn't seem like an obvious moral decision to do that. The only other thing I would say about that is, I'm a big believer in taking people on the journey. That, like that analogy of the oil company wanting to be ethical, there's a big shift happening in social impact investment. So a lot of venture capitalist firms are now actually looking at social impact investment and SoSense startups as being a gold mine, really. In France recently, there was a major superannuation fund or a retirement fund, essentially, that set aside 10% of its investments for you would be in social enterprise or social impact areas, and it was opt-in. And they were overwhelmed by the number of people on the records that said, yes, I'd like you to use 10% of my retirement savings to invest in social impact causes. And I think people, including companies, do want to do good. It's just that you have to show them how to do that, that they can do that, and it's not hard. And that's probably the biggest thing, is no matter how easy something is to do, it's always easy not to do it. So in the event that, you know, if anybody, I suppose, is in on a similar path or wanting to do something similar, and I will only work with ethical, moral companies, you'd be surprised, I think, particularly now in the changing climate that we have, how many companies are willing to actually explore that option of okay, well, how do I actually do better? How do I do good? And fortunately, that's one of the things that we do offer as a service, is actually figuring out for you how you can do your things more ethically, more positive, social impact sense. I did go on a tangent, so I forgot the other question that you had.
No, that's really good. You did address the questions, really. And you went neatly on to what another topic that I wanted to touch on just before we finish up, and that's the future of Spur Labs. And you're touching on things like what you're describing there is the opportunity that you see and being part of that change that you're describing. Is that the future that you see for Spur Labs? Or do you have a very clearly defined future, or are you still just on the journey?
Yes and no. Lee and I talk about it a lot, and you know, to be fair, we're very early on in the process. Well, in one sense. In another sense, we've been doing this for 7 years. It's just that our only clients were ourselves and society, I guess, in a broader sense. What I've noticed is in that one of the reasons that Lee and I do work so well together as a team is that we're very similar in our values and personalities, but also extremely different in our skill sets. So Lee is an amazing creative ideator, and he'll come to me with these ideas that I honestly have no idea what he's taking to get these ideas. Like, it's incredible. And on the flip side, my skill has always been in systems thinking and figuring out how things fit together, figuring out how strategies work, and I'm looking at the big picture of opportunities. And so in that sense, that there seems to be a strong element where Spur Labs excels is in the design of projects and campaigns that create social impact, as well as the more nuts and bolts behind the scenes of looking at how you actually measure social impact and how effective you are. And an example of that is actually just this past week, we were engaged by a brand new campaign in Australia for domestic violence. And we're working with them to figure out the branding of that campaign, who their target market should be, what exact impacts they're trying to have by raising funds, and then what they should do with those funds. And that includes looking at, across the breadth of Australia, what are the domestic violence projects that are happening? How effective are they? And what gap exists that you could use those funds to solve? As well as looking at things like, what are the core drivers and contextual factors around domestic violence? Why does it actually happen? And so if you are going to pick one thing, here's the thing you probably should focus on. And the flip side to that work, or the complementary piece, is WWF has engaged us for Earth Hour to do some metric analysis around if they're using Earth Hour to create a particular awareness in the public, how do you actually measure awareness? And that's a whole area that we're particularly passionate about. And there's a great phrase that we've kind of adopted as a motto, which is that anybody who designs for awareness couldn't figure out how to design for action. And so I see the future of Spur Labs at the moment as being those two core things, creating really compelling projects and campaigns for those that don't have those skills, and helping those that are running those campaigns to make sure they're actually having a really big impact and knowing what impact they're actually having. How big Spur Labs gets, if we want to make this something where we have a number of employees, we want to keep it a small studio, I have no idea. It could be broken in a year and I might come asking you for a job, Barry. I have no idea. Only time will tell. But I would say in many ways, I feel like we've stumbled upon something that the world is ready for. The response we've had from people has been amazing, and people have been genuinely excited not only to work with us, but a number of comments. I personally find it when you're developing an idea, you can gauge pretty quickly if it's a good idea by how people respond to it. And the people that have heard about this story and come to our launch or any of the talks that we've done have gone, oh my God, I wish I had that idea, or I want to be involved in that in some way. I think, and I hope actually, that you'll see more agencies or studios like us cropping up that are insistent upon only working on particular projects and are invested in creating a better world for everybody by the work they're doing. And if that does happen, then that's bloody awesome.
Couldn't agree more. That is, in fact, the whole premise of me doing this series is to speak to people like yourself who are going through this journey and discovering studios, agencies, however we describe ourselves as, and that are focused on this. And I think it is growing. It is interesting, the similarities, as well as everybody coming from different places and different backgrounds and different countries. It's a fascinating conversation journey so far already.
And I think it's a great idea. When I heard about the podcast, I thought, hell yes, this is exactly what we need to highlight that you can do things this way. There was a foundation that I was speaking with recently and they're doing some amazing things. And I said, well, why haven't I heard of you? And they went, oh, we don't want to blow our own trumpet. And we have to kind of get over that attitude, because if you don't show people, even if it's imperfect, we're still figuring things out. But if you don't show people what thought you've had about how to make things better, then you might not inspire somebody else who could have been inspired and made their own change in the world. So I think it's a great, absolutely great idea of what you're doing with the podcast, and I'm sure it's going to be a hit.
Awesome. Thank you for saying that. And also, really thank you for your time today for this interview. I really appreciate that. What you're describing with what they're offering and the and particularly around that measurement stuff of what Spur Labs does is, I think, going to be mind-blowingly valuable. And I cannot see you looking for a job in a year.
Well, so thanks so much. But yeah, it was a pleasure to rant at you across the world there for 45 minutes. But you're asking things that I'm very passionate about. So no, it's been a pleasure.
You can get all the links and notes from this episode on happyporchradio.com, where you can also find out how to send us questions, feedback, and get involved in the conversation about this series. If you enjoyed the show, please share with anyone else who might enjoy it too. Thanks for listening.